Our next argument this morning is United States against Malik.
May it please the court, Marcus Funk.
Mr. Funk.
Apologize. May it please the court, Marcus Funk on behalf of the United States. The defendant in this case pleaded guilty pursuant to a written plea agreement to one count of receipt of child pornography and one count of possession of child pornography. The parties agreed that guideline 2G2.2, which governs the receipt of child pornography, would be the guideline that would drive the defendant's sentence. The district court at sentencing ruled that the word receipt, as found in guideline 2G2.2, was ambiguous, and that based on the district court's analysis of the legislative history, receipt really required an intent to deliver. The government disagreed at that time with the district court's decision and cited Ellison and Richardson for the proposition that, in fact, receipt is clear. The distinction between receipt and possession is a viable distinction, and that, therefore, the defendant should have been sentenced based on his receipt of child pornography pursuant to 2G2.2. Subsequent to the district court's decision, the Seventh Circuit issued this opinion in Myers, which is cited as supplemental authority, and that further underscores that the district court erred when it sentenced the defendant on the basis of the possession guideline. The defendant, in the defendant's response brief, concedes that this was an error on the part of the district court, but the defendant now claims that the defendant, in fact, never pled guilty to receipt, that rather the defendant pled, that the district court rejected the defendant's plea of guilty to receipt, instead only accepting the defendant's plea as to the lesser included offense of possession. That claim finds no support in the record. It is inconsistent with the judgment and committal. It is inconsistent with the forfeiture orders. It's
inconsistent with the procedure, too. If a proposed plea of guilty is rejected, what follows next is trial, not sentencing. So I don't understand on the defendant's view why he wasn't put to trial on the charge in the indictment.
And Your Honor, we agree it would be a violation of Rule 11 if the district court had, in fact, done what the defendant purports to claim that the district court did do. And if there was any question, which there isn't, but if there was any question, certainly when the district court clarified its intent, it left no doubt that what its intent was to accept
it. Is there any ambiguity in the judgment? It looks like the judgment refers to the receipt crime. This is the crime for which the defendant is being sentenced.
Yes, Your Honor. The judgment states that the defendant pled guilty to receipt and possession of child pornography. And as the court points out, there really, from the government's perspective, and I believe in a fair reading of the record in its entirety, and certainly with regard to the defendant, the district court's ruling on its motion for clarification, there can be no doubt that the district court accepted the defendant's receipt plea, and that therefore, based on the arguments that we made in the brief and also the arguments presented to the court today, that the defendant should have been sentenced based on 2G2.2. With regard to the defendant's supplemental memorandum, with regard to the Blakely argument, I'll simply point out that as an initial matter, this argument was not ever raised in the district court.
What difference would that make? On your view, there has to be a resentencing. And, of course, at the new sentencing, any argument based on Blakely and Booker can be raised.
We agree, Your Honor.
Well, also, there's no jeopardy here, is there? I mean, if I have problems with how Judge Shader did this and what he did, but you could charge, just reissue an indictment charging receipt and go to trial. There's been no trial here. There's no jeopardy.
That is correct, Your Honor. And certainly that is an option that we also reserved and pointed out to the defendant. So if there are no further questions, Your Honors, we would ask that this court revert and remand for resentencing and would reserve the remainder.
Before you sit down, tell me, how do you possess something without receiving it?
Your Honor, one way to possess something without receiving it is, for example, if I found that this binder on the street, opened it up, looked at it, found that it contained child pornography, and decided to keep it. I did not knowingly receive child pornography, but rather I knowingly possessed child pornography. That is one way, and that's perhaps the most common way that one can, at least in terms of how the law describes it, one can be convicted of receipt, rather of possession of child pornography without having fulfilled the requirements of receipt.
Yeah, both sides appear unaware that there's a long history of that very question dealing with bank robbery, right? Because the bank robber robs the bank and he receives the proceeds from the teller and he then possesses the proceeds as he goes out. And that's led to a long series of cases in the Supreme Court over more than 50 years about what can you convict the bank robber of? When are you supposed to convict him of possession? When are you supposed to convict him of receipt? And so on. One would think that this would follow that pattern, but there we are.
Oh, another thing.
Why?
Possession is a pretty minor, it's a misdemeanor here, isn't it?
It is not, Your Honor. It is a felony. Possession of child pornography is a felony offense.
Well, it's a lesser offense than punishment is left under the guidelines for possession and receipt.
That's correct.
So why do you charge both? If the receipt Your guideline Honor. Controls, he's going to plead guilty, charge him with two things. Why take a plea on both?
Frankly, we didn't know at the time whether the defendant was going to plead guilty or not plead guilty. And so for purposes of the evidence, the receipt, the evidence for receipt of child pornography would be different from the evidence for possession of child pornography. With regard to why the defendant pled guilty to both, again, the receipt guideline drove the sentence. I can't really speak to why the defense decided to plead guilty to both. But
well, everybody agreed on how this was going to proceed except Judge Shader.
That is correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
And before you sit down, counsel, the district court clarification order and the judgment both provide an alternative explanation for what exactly was going on here. And would you address yourself to that, whether what the judge did is justifiable as a downward departure? I think he gave that as a backup explanation for what he was doing.
That's correct, Your Honor. The judge ruled that if setting aside his argument about the legislative history, that the conduct charged here and pled to here would be outside the heartland, we believe that given our argument as to the fact that in fact this is entirely within the heartland, that this conduct that was charged and that pled guilty to it and that is received is within the heartland, and so therefore we would argue that as the first argument of the district judge falls, the second one must fall as well.
Is that even an available justification for a downward departure on a child pornography charge?
Your Honor, I can't say that I've ever seen this argument. In fact, I can't say that there's a case in any district that I'm aware of that supports this argument.
Crimes involving children are a special category under the guidelines, isn't that right? In terms of available justifications for downward departures?
Your Honor, I know that in this case, the argument that this conduct charge would be outside the heartland is simply contrary to all available case law. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Fox.
May it please the Court, my name is Bill Tyson. I represent Mr. Malik. I think if the questioning has brought out any win that the government might obtain here today would be, if not a pyrrhic victory, at least a somewhat inconsequential victory, because it's going to go back and the judge is going to have to decide this case in terms of Blakely, the meaning of which we don't even know at this point, which may become evident later. But we have raised a question of appellate jurisdiction, and we think it's an important issue of appellate jurisdiction, and we're not prepared to say, well, forget about jurisdiction because we know that we can raise Blakely on.
No one is ever prepared to say forget about jurisdiction, but I must say, Mr. Tyson, I don't understand the jurisdictional point. Plainly a final judgment in the district court. District judge has done everything he ever plans to do. There's this judgment of conviction and sentence, and that's an appealable judgment. It's not an interlocutory order. It's not your position that we are now going to go to trial on something else. We all agree this case is over in the district court.
No, Your Honor, we do not. And I think
so you think a trial is pending on some other charge in the district court?
There is an unresolved charge, because remember, Judge Shader said very clearly,
this judgment says conviction on count one, count two dismissed. What's pending?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, are you looking at the judgment of conviction? And there is a problem with the government's appendix. The government filed an inaccurate, incomplete appendix. You really need to take a look at the appellee's appendix to get the complete judgment that was entered in this case. And when you do, and we pointed this out in our brief.
Look, is this not an accurate copy of the judgment? It says defendant pleaded guilty to counts one and two. It then names the offense, right? One is receipt, one is possession, count number one, count number two.
Yes, sir, but it's incomplete, because there is a later page in the judgment which the government did not include in their appendix, but which is included in our appendix, and that is an unnumbered page that says statement of reasons. And that's where the court talks about finding him guilty of the lesser included offense of possession. And that is something that the court told the government from the get-go, which I take that back, not the get-go, because remember, Mr. Malik pleaded guilty to count one as charged. Later on, Judge Shader said,
let me put it a different way. This judgment is on its face a judgment on counts one and two, right? Your view that this was somehow a partial dismissal just drops this into the Criminal Appeals Act paragraph 1, which says the government can appeal from any partial dismissal, even if it's interlocutory.
Not really, Your Honor.
See where we go.
You're raising a point that the government has not raised, and I'm not sure it's because they haven't thought of it or because they see some problems with it. And here's the problem. Judge Shader told them long before the sentencing, I'm going to sentence him on a lesser-included offense. The government filed a motion for reconsideration and quarreled with his interpretation of the statute, but it did not make any protest of his stated intention to sentence on a lesser included offense. They could have said,
I just think you're talking a language that is not a language describing actual events in federal practice. A sentence is imposed on an offense. One can adopt, what Judge Shader said he was doing was adopting the guideline used for a lesser included offense. That may be a correct step or an incorrect step, but it is not a step that has anything to do with a conviction on a lesser included offense. He's selecting a guideline to use.
I'm not making this up. I don't have that much imagination. I will agree with you fully that what Judge Shader did was very bizarre, but the government had
it's not bizarre.
In its own hands.
It may be right or wrong, but it's a perfectly normal procedure to say, I am going to choose the guideline that I think best fits the real nature of this offense.
That's not what he
said. We have said, after Judge Shader acted, that in Myers, that was not the right thing to do. But
And we agree
with all the time
with Myers. We're not challenging Myers, but I would emphasize that the judgment is all the pages. It's not just page one, and that is what is so misleading about the government's appendix, which I might also add never included the actual sentencing procedure, where Judge Shader again talked about sentencing him on a lesser included offense. This is not a case where he convicts him and sentences him on the charged offense and uses a different guideline. This is, as bizarre and zany as it may seem, a case where he says, I'm going to find you guilty of a lesser included offense and convict you accordingly. And the government sat on its thumbs all the time, never protested, and now they're in a situation where they cannot...
Well, is it your view that your brief has waived any double jeopardy defense to another prosecution for possession?
Absolutely not. If the government wants to go back and try to charge him, there will be double jeopardy problems as well as due process problems.
Then your position must be this is a final disposition of this indictment. And if it's a final disposition of this indictment, it's appealable. If it's a non-final disposition of this indictment, it's appealable under paragraph 1 of the Criminal Appeals Act. I just don't understand what could possibly be left.
I think we're forgetting the possibility that although the government disagrees with what Judge Shader did with respect to the greater offense, it never made a record. It forfeited any right to appeal what it might have seen as his violation of Rule 11. When he told them that I'm going to set aside the guilty plea...
The only way you forfeit an opportunity to appeal is not to get your appeal filed on time.
Another way you can do it is by not making your record below. Just like defendants, the government
has
to make
nothing to do with appellate jurisdiction. That concerns what arguments are open on appeal. It is not a jurisdictional concern, even remotely.
So are there any further questions that the court has on this?
Is there any doubt that if we have jurisdiction, we need to reverse?
If you have jurisdiction, and I think we were very straightforward about this, you're going to reverse. And then we're back in likely land. And that's why I say whatever government victory is being sought here today is really inconsequential. But the question of jurisdiction is important, and as I say...
We will leave it to the Supreme Court to decide Booker, and then presumably on remand, the district court will proceed as Booker requires, as the Supreme Court's decision in Booker requires.
If this court decides it has jurisdiction over the appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Tice. Anything further, Mr. Funk?
Your Honor, just one point. Mr. Tice makes an issue of our lack of inclusion of the statement of reasons. As the court can see, in fact, as clear from the one page that Mr. Tice included in his brief, it states not for public disclosure. This is a document that is sealed. As the court knows, comes to the court under seal. We did not include it for that reason. Other than that, there are no further questions, Your Honors. We ask that you reverse and remand for resentencing.
Thank you, Counsel.
Can I make just a one-sentence response?
No.
May I follow up with the letter? Because there's a
Mr. Tice, if you believe it is necessary to, you may file it, and we will assess whether it's proper.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.